All right, here I am. God bless. Do you want to have a seat? Oh, okay, you can have a seat. I was telling Tom, I actually like teaching earlier in the weekend, so for two reasons, actually. One is so that I can have a bunch to eat Sunday morning, and so which I'm sure everybody got carb overloaded, but also people can clean up after me, so we'll see how it goes. But anyways, you can turn your Bibles open to Hebrews chapter 6, and we're going to pick up where Katie left off. Thanks again, Tom, for asking me to teach and letting me be a part of that study group. I think on the behalf of all the teachers, you know, we're only presenting a portion of what we discussed and debated and disagreed about and agreed on. And really what you're getting is just a byproduct, a small little byproduct of what we were able to do. But I'm hoping you're seeing that, at least from the theme of this book and the essence, that it's really an urgent plea for this group of individuals of Hebrews to be able to just believe what has already been, what they know, what they've been exposed to, what they're aware of, and that this Son, Jesus Christ, was the fulfillment of everything that God had been working up to this point. And that, you know, the one thing that Tom mentioned, I think yesterday, just regarding the kind of the undertone of this book is the difference between mercy and urgency. And up to this point, it's just, today you need to believe there's not another one coming. There's not going to be another sacrifice. There's not going to be another man. There's not going to be another priest. The things that I had set up before are less than. They're not just different. Jesus Christ isn't just new. Jesus Christ is better. Jesus Christ is superior. And there's an urgency there. There's an urgency. You believe that today. Believe that today. Okay, we'll explain some more. We'll believe that today. And that's where we come to this man named Melchizedek. You know, who the heck is Melchizedek? Aren't you excited to learn about Melchizedek? Yeah. Oh, great. Well, what? why should you be excited to learn about Melchizedek, though? That's the question I would ask. Is like, when I first approached this, it's, who is Melchizedek? Like, okay, let's learn about him then. So, We've heard seen his name come up in just passing in a few other chapters. We've seen the mentioning of high priest come up multiple times. In this chapter of chapter 7, what we're going to be covering is how the author is going to be addressing that group, specifically those two points, that Melchizedek was a high priest. Melchizedek not just preceded the Levitical law and the system and the priests that were under the Levitical law. He didn't just precede them in chronology, but he superseded them. And that Melchizedek was superior to what God set up in the law. And Jesus Christ, in verse 20 of chapter 6, says, "Whither the forerunner is for us entered, even Jesus, made a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." So what we're going to see is how Jesus was after the order of Melchizedek. There was another order. And we're gonna learn more about that in this chapter. But the order that God had set up in the law was the order of Aaron. That there was one family that came from one tribe. And that priests would only be allowed from that one family. And specifically, there was a high priest. Okay, out of the group of priests, only one individual could be high, the high priest. And that individual, once a year, would be able to allow to go into the holiest of holies. He was the only one who had direct access to the presence of God. We're going to talk a little bit about how Melchizedek preceded that, and how could Jesus Christ be of that order, which superseded the order of Aaron. So let's learn about Melchizedek. You'll have to turn to Genesis chapter 14. This is where Melchizedek comes up. You know, you would think that because the author in Hebrews mentioned Melchizedek so often, that Melchizedek must have been some man of huge volumes in the Word of God, right? That there would have been a lot of details given about him, that he would have been mentioned significantly throughout the course of the Old Testament, that these Hebrews should have had respect regarding this man. There's only four verses in the whole Old Testament about Melchizedek. And we're going to read three of them here. In Genesis chapter 14, to give you a little bit of background in Genesis 14, we don't have time to go through the whole chapter, but there was a king who ruled for 12 years, and then in the 13th year, there was five other kings around him that rebelled against him. Okay, So what that king did is he got some kings that didn't rebel against him to go to war with the five kings who rebelled. So it was 4 verses 5. And it appears that the original king crushed the other five. He won, and he took some spoils. He took some of the stuff from the battle, some goods from the battle that he won by conquering the five rebellious kings. And so the original king's army also took and captured Lot. Okay, you remember Lot? He was a part of the kingdom of one of those rebel kings. So the original king took and captured Lot. And then someone from that party who was captured that was near Lot and knew Lot escaped, and he went and told Abraham. And then Abraham took his people, and they pursued after that group and that army who took and captured Lot to get Lot back. And they rescued Lot, and they regained all of Lot's goods, because Lot's goods were taken from the original battle. And on their way home, Lot and Abraham, they met this man, Melchizedek, okay? Just out of nowhere. And so verse 18 is where we're going to pick up the record. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abraham of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the Most High God, which hath delivered thy enemies into thy hand," and he gave him tithes of all. Talking about Abraham gave Melchizedek tithes of all. That's pretty much the entire record of Melchizedek. And so, you know, Melchizedek met Abraham, and what happened is Melchizedek is, it says right here, he's a priest of the Most High God. He is somebody who blessed Abraham. He blessed God. Abraham gave him a tithe of all, and then there's no more mentioning of him. And let's go back to Hebrews chapter 7. In one sense, this weekend's been, I don't know about for you, but it's been a little bit easier in the sense that the things that we're reading about in the book of Hebrews, one, are not addressed to us, and two, they're because of the distance and the sense that we're not that of that group, and even some of the application that's being made to the Hebrews as a group to really take to and believe to the end what God is working regarding the end of and Jesus and the system they set up. You know, it we're kind of separated from that, but nevertheless, I hope that and trust that for you, going through this weekend, it's even though these topics, like, I'm not necessarily going to pursue after the details regarding Melchizedek on my own personal study, but if it didn't come up here in Hebrews, right? But you're seeing that all these details really has helped elevated the superiority of Christ, that Christ is superior, and that if you believe that and acknowledge that, then what doesn't that affect in the rest of life practically? It's not just, oh man, I'm so glad I got a bunch of ammunition now to go help those other Jews now, you know, and convince them they really need to know about Jesus. If it goes from here to help the Jews, what has it really done? And you know, the Word of God, as we've heard so often in the manifestations throughout the course of this weekend, it's for us, and it's got life. It's for to change us, to teach us. And if it hasn't helped elevate Christ and your mind and heart, then keep your ears and open to the rest of this to see, you know, one last call for you, that this chapter can help you see Christ bigger. But nevertheless, in Hebrews chapter 1, we're talking about Melchizedek. "For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him." So it's basically reiterating some of the things that we read about in the book of Genesis, that Melchizedek, this man Melchizedek met Abraham. He was also a king. He was a king. He was also a priest. And verse 2, it says, "To whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all, first being by interpretation king of righteousness, and after that also king of Salem, which is king of peace." So Melchizedek wasn't just any man. He wasn't just some mere worshiper of God. He was the priest of the Most High God at that point in time. You've got to keep in mind that Melchizedek was way, way before the law was given underneath Moses. So this man was a priest. Now, I wish I brought my props up too. I know everybody's had props. You remember the picture Josh showed? I was going to show you. That was a priest according to the order of Aaron. Okay, Melchizedek was not that. So when you think of a high priest, okay, with respect to Melchizedek, it's not necessarily the robes and the garments and the stones and things like this. Melchizedek was a totally different individual. He nevertheless, Melchizedek blessed Abraham, and he blessed God. And Abraham gave Melchizedek a tenth part of all. A tenth is a tithe. If you read the word tithe in the Old Testament, that just means tenth. And in this case, Abraham gave him a tenth of all. All could either be all of Abraham's possessions or all of the spoils that he took. And it appears in the context it was basically a tenth of the spoils that he took from that war. And what I think is interesting is how that this author is trying to prove to these individuals, the Jews, that Jesus is after the order of Melchizedek. And for a couple reasons, not only to be able to prove that Jesus was a legitimate high priest, but there, remember we read about previously that a high priest's function was to offer up gifts and sacrifices for sin. That in order for Jesus to be able to offer up a perfect sacrifice, or any sacrifice for that matter, he needed to be a legitimate high priest. And he was not of the order of Aaron. He was of a totally different order. How is that possible? Well, there's a couple things that are going to come up here. And in verse 3, you see, without father, without mother, without descent, having neither beginning of days nor end of days, but made like unto the Son of God, abideth a priest continually. And so this Melchizedek, this is talking about Melchizedek. He's without father and without mother. And that when you read in the book of Genesis, you don't read anything about his mother or his father or his genealogy. You don't read anything about his parents. He just shows up on the scene and he departs, right? There's nothing there with his genealogy. He has no descent. You don't read about any of his children. It's never recorded about whether this man had children. He's got neither beginning of days nor end of life. You don't read about his birth. You don't read about his death. History and with respect to the records in Genesis do not reveal anything regarding those things. Why is that important? Why is that important? Because all of the priests, according to the law, had to have their genealogy recorded. They had to be able to trace their pedigree from every single generation back to the original. And if they were unable to, they would not be able to be a priest. Now, for example, hold your finger here, but we're going to go to Ezra 2. I want to show you this. It was essential, absolutely essential, that the Levitical priest be able to prove their ancestry. Ezra 2. This is when the Jews were returning from the captivity to Jerusalem. There were certain priestly families that could not produce the records to prove their genealogy, and therefore they were debarred from the priesthood. They couldn't prove it. It's not a matter of just words. Can you prove it? And look here in chapter 2, verse 61, and of the children of the priests, and the children of Habiah, the children of Koz, the children of Barzillia, which took a wife of the daughters of Barzillia the Gilead, and was called after their name, these sought their register among those that were reckoned by genealogy. But they were not found. Therefore, they were polluted or defiled, and they were put from the priesthood. They were excluded from the priesthood. They couldn't prove it, so they were excluded. That's how serious it was under the law, that you needed to prove your genealogy. You can turn back to Hebrews chapter 7. Genealogy on the part of a Hebrew who was a priest was essential. It was literally everything. What's different about this man Melchizedek and no known genealogy, no known father, no known birth, no known death, no records regarding those things, is that his qualifications to be a priest had nothing to do with genealogy. His qualifications had to do had nothing to do with his bloodline, had nothing to do with what he inherited. It had everything to do with just who he was. He was the high priest of God. And that this new and better priesthood, it was based on his own personal qualifications. It wasn't based upon what he inherited. Melchizedek's qualifications were completely personal. And so Melchizedek was made like the Son of God. That's one of the statement that comes up in verse 3 at the very end. But made like unto the Son of God. We've mentioned it previously in this weekend that what came first, the law or God's idea for a redeemer? You know, God, you know, the Son, the Redeemer, the Messiah, the plan, that was all something that God had in advance. And then he came up with a system that would reflect and shadow that they could work in and with, that would continue to point to what God had already envisioned in advance and would fulfill later after the fact. That's where, it again, Melchizedek was made like unto the Son of God. It really isn't that Jesus had Melchizedek has Jesus kind of priesthood, okay? It's not that Melchizedek sets the pattern and then Jesus follows it, all right? And that the order of Melchizedek is it abideth a priest continually. So since the record in Moses, or in Genesis, doesn't record his death, his life, his father's genealogy, he abides a priest perpetually or continually. You know, I'll put that in like quotes. Because he was a man, he didn't live forever, he died. But because the record is lacking those limits, it's as if that man was a priest forever. Jesus abides a priest like that. He is after that order, one who is a priest forever. And so the question's got to be asked, as I've alluded to so many times, is that if all of this is true, how can it be proved that the priesthood of Melchizedek is superior and greater to the priesthood of Aaron? How can that be? And so verse 4 and through 10 is really going to help cover that, and we'll keep going. And now consider in verse 4 how great this man was, unto whom even the patriarch Abraham gave the tenth of the spoils. So Melchizedek is greater than Abraham because Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek. Paid tithes to Melchizedek. Melchizedek took a tenth from Abraham. He took a tenth. So it wasn't for Melchizedek's maintenance, for he was a king. Melchizedek was a king. I don't really think it was so that Melchizedek could survive, but it was because he was high priest. And also realize here that the word patriarch is given, that the title to Abraham is patriarch. Here applied by way of prominence, that Abraham was the head of all heads of the family. He was the father of all fathers for the tribe of Israel. That it started with Abraham. He was the first one, okay? If he paid a tenth to Melchizedek, then the one who's the greatest that we associate ourselves to paid a tithe, then Melchizedek must be greater than Abraham. And it goes on in verse 5, and verily they that are of the sons of Levi, who receive the office of the priesthood, have a commandment to take tithes of the people according to the law, that is of their brethren, though they come out of the loins of Abraham. That have you ever read the record about the tithe and what the tithe was for? Let's turn, keep your hands here. We'll just go to Numbers chapter 18. And there's a few verses that indicate very clearly what the tithe was for and the purpose of the tithe. At least one purpose. In chapter 18 of Numbers, verse 20, and the Lord spake unto Aaron, thou shalt have no inheritance in their land, neither shalt thou have any part among them. Okay, so when they entered into the promised land, there was 12 tribes, and each of the tribes got a particular piece of land. And the tribe of Levi, they did not have a land, but they had a particular type of service that they were to do. And it says, I am thy part and thine inheritance among the children of Israel. In verse 21, and behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tenth in Israel for an inheritance, for their service which they serve, even the service of the tabernacle of the congregation. So the way that this individual tribe who didn't have land, their function was going to be continual service in the tabernacle. But what was going to allow them to be able to function without having land was all the other 11 tribes were going to give them a tenth of their goods and the fruit of their lands to help them. So everybody was contributing to that. So the tenth of every single other tribe was given to the tribe of Levi for their purposes. Okay? So that's the tenth. Turn back to Hebrews 7. And so the Levites were to receive a tenth part of everything for their service in the tabernacle. And what's interesting is that you read in this verse, in verse 5 of Hebrews 7, that they received the tithe by commandment, okay? That was something God set up and instituted underneath the law, and that it was a requirement, that the tithe at that point in time was a legal enactment. What allows Melchizedek to be greater than those priests is that Abraham gave it to him not because of a legal requirement. There was no legal requirement. Abraham gave it to him freely. Abraham gave it to him voluntarily. Additionally, it says that they tithe their brethren, okay? So you've got the Hebrews, although it was according to the law, who were they receiving the goods from? They're receiving it from other Jews. They're receiving it from the brethren. What allows Melchizedek to be greater than them is he didn't receive it from his brethren, some family member. He received it from a complete, total stranger. That allows him to be greater. And, you know, there's no racial connection. There was no legal requirement. And so this Abraham giving to Melchizedek is greater than Israel's payment of tithes underneath the Levitical priesthood. In verse 6, but he whose descent is not counted from them received tithes of Abraham and blessed him that had the promises. And so what this means, that first phrase, but he whose descent is not counted from them, just means that Melchizedek was not one of the children of Israel. He wasn't accounted of them. The NIV handles it a little better. It says that this man, however, did not trace his descent from Levi. Yet he collected a tenth from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises. And so another way that Melchizedek is greater than the priests underneath the law is that here's Abraham who had the promises. And yet Melchizedek is the one who blessed Abraham. You would think it would be the opposite way around, right? You would think that here's the one who got the promise from God. He would be, you know, so magnanimous to be able to bless you. You know, I've talked to God. I've got the promises. I will dispense the blessings around. It was the opposite way around. Here's Melchizedek, who's the high priest, and he blesses Abraham. In verse 7, it says, and without all contradiction, the less is blessed of, the better. The better. So there it is right there, that greater people bless lesser people, right? Very simply. I'm glad I put it there for you. And for me too. Therefore, Melchizedek showed he was greater than Abraham when he blessed Abraham. When Abraham accepted the blessing, he was showing that Melchizedek was greater. And so two ways in which Melchizedek is greater than Abraham is that he blessed Abraham and he received the tithe from Abraham. And in verse 8, it continues. And here men die, receive tithes. And here men that die receive tithes. But there he receiveth of whom it is witnessed that he liveth. This is a kind of a challenging verse. Let me talk about the two words here and there. Here, it, I think, indicates like present day that the author is writing about and the moment that he's writing, you know, the moment of the writer here. You know, the current Mosaic institutions and practices. So underneath those here in this system, men die. So the Levites who receive tithes are only men. And what happens to those men? There's a terminus, yes. And there, talking about in the record in Genesis, but there Melchizedek receiveth them of whom it is witnessed that he liveth. How was it witnessed that Melchizedek lives? There was no record of him dying. There was no record of him having limits, right? So here men die. There, in that record, he lives forever. Why is that important? Well, it's important because it goes on in verse 9. And as I may say, so say, Levi also, who receiveth tithes, paid tithes in Abraham. For he was yet in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. And so here it is. This is a pretty big statement. This should be like the clincher for these individuals, that in a sense, Levi was a couple generations after Abraham. Figuratively, he was still in the loins of Abraham. Okay? I don't need to explain that. But Abraham was the father of all those who would follow after him, including Levi. So if Abraham paid a tithe to Melchizedek, then that means that Melchizedek must be greater than all those who follow. You know, pretty simple, really, right? This shows that Melchizedek is in a position of superiority, of excellence, and that I would never use this logic, but if the writer didn't use it and proven to these individuals, but it's still true, and he's still showing. This man, Melchizedek, is not just, you should have known about him. He was recorded about. I love how this whole, up to this point, the author, and specifically God, is just using a case against them. They're familiar with these things. They should have been familiar with these things. You know about the Levitical priesthood. You know about it. Okay, I'm not asking you to forsake that. I'm asking you to accept as something superior. I'm asking you to look at something that is so much better. And, you know, the Melchizedek was better than Levi. Melchizedek was better than the priesthood that came underneath the law. And so, you know, this first section between verses 1 through 10 are captured by a statement, Melchizedek met Abraham. And so he just spent 10 verses talking about how Melchizedek is better than the priesthood because Melchizedek is better than Abraham. And the reason why Melchizedek's better than Abraham, the tithe, the blessing, the how the priest, as Melchizedek lives forever, how that priest is better than the Levites that follow after because they're still in the loins of Abraham. So if you still want to hold to your priesthood, okay, by the scriptures, all those things have been superseded, right? And, oh, by the way, Jesus is after that order. He's after that order. So in a series of contrasts, the writer has worked out the superiority of Melchizedek. And so why would God replace the Levitical priesthood? Why would God want to replace that? If the Levitical priesthood was good enough, Jesus would have functioned as a part of that, right? So why replace it at all? And the rest of this chapter is going to start describing the limitations and the imperfections of the Levitical priesthood, that the weakness and unprofitability of the law, the imperfections of the men, the personal characters of those men. Not just that those men die and that those men have sinned, but those men and their personal characters had failures. And so verse 11 continues to talk about why he would replace that Levitical priesthood. In verse 11, if therefore perfection were by the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should rise after the order of Melchizedek and not be called after the order of Aaron? That's the question I just asked, right? That if it was if it were sufficient for Jesus to function as a priest under the Aaron, why was there any need for a different one? And I'll point out here that if therefore perfection were by the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law. You know, most people think that or interpret under it as under the priesthood. For under it the people received the law, right? So under what? Under the priesthood they received the law? Well, that's not true, right? The law came prior to the priesthood. The law is what dictated the priesthood. A better handling of it is that under it, it could be as on account of it. On account of it. You know, the law was given before any priesthood was established, but the whole law depended upon the priesthood. That the priesthood was necessary because the law would be constantly broken. The priesthood was necessary because they needed an individual to cover and perform sacrifices to atone for the breaking of the law. So it was on account of the priesthood that the people received the law. And, you know, why would God make a different order of priesthood if the Levitical priesthood were entirely sufficient? And this is going to show, it's going to start showing the lack. It's going to start showing the lack. In verse 12, for the priesthood being changed, there is made of necessity a change also of the law. That this is one of those statements that says that if the priesthood is changed, if Melchizedek predates the priesthood that came underneath the law according to Moses, then there also must be a change in the status or position of the law. Okay? And so that the place it holds in the life of the Jew. And so that's why it says that there is made of necessity a change of the law also. That the very essence of the law, although it had the offerings and the sacrifices that covered for sin, it could never make an individual perfect. It could never could make an individual perfect. It could never totally reconcile man to God, right? Because there was daily sacrifices that had to be offered. It was constant sacrifices. It couldn't do it perpetually. It could never purify the heart of a man, okay? It could pay for that sin. It could clean them externally so that God could dwell among them, but it could never purify the heart. It never opened up the kingdom of heaven to man. And so, you know, if there is a change in priesthood, there's a change in the necessity and the place and the status of the law. In verse 13, for he of whom these things are spoken pertaineth to another tribe, of which no man gave attendance at the altar. This is talking about that under the law of Moses, there was a strict, like I mentioned, there was a strict command that the priest could only come from the family of Aaron and from the tribe of Levi. So here, this man, he never attended at the altar. And furthermore, in verse 14, it is evident that our Lord sprang out of Judah, of which tribe Moses spake nothing concerning priesthood. So it's evident. Everyone knows that Jesus did not come from Levi. He didn't come from that tribe. So how can he be a priest? How can he be a priest? It's got to be a legitimate question that the Jews would stumble upon. And, you know, therefore, if he didn't come from Levi, he didn't come from Aaron, how could he be a priest? And that's why in verse 15 it says, it is yet far more evident for that after the similitude or the likeness of Melchizedek, there arises another priest. That Jesus is our high priest, it must be not according to that system that God set up according to the law, but another principle after the order of Melchizedek. It shows that the whole system is superseded, that something greater than the priesthood and the law has come, something greater than that. And it says in verse 16, who was made not after the law of a carnal commandment, but after the power of an endless life. So this word carnal doesn't necessarily mean sinful or corrupt in this case. It's the word for fleshly, that it was just frail or weak, that God still gave the commandment underneath the law, right? And God set up the Levites according to his word. So what God set up was good. But it was weak in the sense that it was unable to fulfill the entire intention that God had originally. And that's how it was frail and weak. And that this man, this priest, was not after that weak or frail commandment. He was after the power of an endless life. That you know, this new priesthood was dependent on a life that is indestructible. That word endless life is indestructible. That Christ's priesthood depended not on physical things, but what he was in himself. And here was a revel it was This was a revolutionary thing. It was no longer outward ceremonies and observances that made a priest, but it was his inward worth. And that's why the quote here in verse 17 testifies to that. That in verse 17 it says, "He testifies that thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." This is a quote from Psalm 110, verse 4, that God foretold that there would be a change in the priesthood. Remember that record in Genesis predated Abraham, predated the law. It was only three verses regarding this high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. It showed how Abraham blessed Melchizedek. Abraham tied to Melchizedek. This Melchizedek was superior to all the system that would come thereafter. And God, by way of, in Psalm 119, he makes a promise as well that there's going to be a priest after that order who's going to be forever. That's going to be forever. And this can never be said about the order of Aaron, that none of the priests from Aaron had the power of an endless life, that each of whom served at a limited time and they, according to their own lifespan. But this man, Melchizedek, he's got an order forever. And Jesus Christ is according to that order. Jesus Christ is qualified according to that order to be a high priest that's superior to your system that you're accustomed to. And then the next two verses transition. They transition to summarize what's been coming up regarding this priesthood. In verse 18, "For there is verily a disannulling of the commandment going before for the weakness and unprofitableness thereof." And so God has superseded the priesthood. God has superseded the law. God has replaced the law with a better new system. And that new better system was going to be able to do what the old one could not do. The old system could not bring man into a full, permanent, glorious, intimate relationship with God. Okay? And so there is verily a disannulling. The disannulling is the same word for putting away that comes up later in Hebrews. And when it's used there, it talks about the putting away of sin, that the putting away of sin by the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. Just as sin was put away, the law is being put away as well, right? And it's the disappearance of the law is absolute. The reason why God is disannulling it with respect to this man, in respect to this order, in respect to this new agreement, is because the law was weak. The law was weak and it was unprofitable. So you got to ask yourself, well, in what way was it weak and what way was it unprofitable, right? If it came from a God who only wants the profit of man and it came from a God who is strong, why would he give something so shallow? Well, it was weak and unprofitable because it never really restored that relationship to God in a full, satisfying, glorious way. That the law was, it required perfect obedience, but it furnished no real assistance to those who were under it. Do you understand? That the law gave all these institutes and told you what to do, but it never really gave the ability or the help to do it. All it did was give you an ability to cover for it when you broke it. And so it was weak to give life. It was weak to give power over that sin. And that although the law performed a valuable function, its essential weakness is that it never gave vitality to those who wanted to keep it, let alone those who didn't. And it just didn't provide that strength. Additionally, it was unprofitable. The law was unprofitable, not in the sense that it was totally worthless, right? It still was able to show man what God liked, what God didn't like. It gave them a temporary access to God. It gave them a means of being able to be close to him. It allowed them to be protected. It allowed them to live amongst each other without strife. It gave them a standard. It showed them what God was ultimately working in Jesus Christ in the future. There was a lot of profit there. But it was ineffective in that it was totally inadequate to provide a sacrifice that was going to be fully covering. And that's where in verse 19, again, just summarizing the context, For the law made nothing perfect, but the bringing in of a better hope did, by the which we draw nigh unto God. There was never perfection underneath the law. There was never perfection. There is, though, an introduction to a better hope. There is if you can read about in the law what God was working in light of the future for the Jews, right? What was he working in light? That there would be a man who would come, that man would live a life, that man would be among them, that man would be able to fulfill everything that they were aware of. You know, Katie mentioned some things regarding how there were some individuals at Jesus' birth who were waiting for him, that they knew according to what God had showed them through his word and had showed them that there was a Messiah that was going to be the Redeemer on their behalf. And that the Jews' hope included, you know, his birth, that a man would come. You know, so when you read this word hope right here, that a better hope, that it, the bringing of a better hope, it's talking about it's not talking about the same hope that you and I would share in, right? Our hope has to do with future events, you know, future events. That the hope for the Jews, particularly those individuals who were under the law and were not born, that were unbelievers, or not born again, what was their hope? It had to do with the fulfillment in this man Christ. That this man Christ, who would not be somebody who would be like a priest, who would die, who would not be somebody who was frail and had to continue to offer up sacrifices, whose character was unholy and defiled, that this they wouldn't have to continue to offer daily sacrifices for sin, that there would be limitations to the access of God, that there would be somebody who would bar, or that there would be bars between the relationship that man and God could hold, that the Jews' hope was in one who would be able to finally grant access to that man, okay? And that their hope was in Jesus, not the law, And so that's what this author in God is trying to get them, that the law made nothing perfect, that you forsaking the law isn't that you're giving up on God, or you forsaking the, you know, you recognizing the disannulling of the law is not you, folding, right? It's there's a better hope. There's a better hope, and it's in Jesus, that anyone who wants to continue to hold on to that old system is, you know, as Katie said, you're crucifying him again, and you're rejecting what God was always working from the beginning, and you're turning away this much better hope that's being offered to you, and that this hope is what allows them to draw nigh unto God. That finally, that Jesus can do what the old priesthood could never do. That Jesus can give you access into God in a permanent way, in a glorious way. And in verse 20, it says, "Inasmuch as not without an oath he was made priest. For those priests, in verse 21, were made without an oath. But this with an oath, by him that said unto him, the Lord swear and will not repent, thou art a priest forever at the order of Melchizedek." So again, it's just quoting that quote from Psalm 110 again, that this man, Melchizedek, is superior to all of this, partly because God made an oath. God made a promise that there was going to be another priest that was going to supersede that old system. And Jesus is according to that. Jesus is according to that order. In verse 22, "By so much was Jesus made a surety of a better testament." And that word testament is the same word that's translated covenant throughout this book and in other places. And that the old priesthood was really the heart of that old testament, that old covenant that God made. That this new priesthood would be connected with a new covenant, a new testament, which is superior to the old one. And so since this new priest has come, there's also a new covenant that's come as well. And Jesus is the surety of that. Jesus is the surety of this new agreement between God and man. And that this word surety is a person who, you know, like co-signs a loan or guarantees a payment. And that he is so much more. He's so much more of a surety under this new agreement than anything was in the past according to the old agreement. That Jesus, overwhelming superiority is able to guarantee this new agreement on our behalf. That there was no one underneath the old agreement to really guarantee our end of the bargain. There was really no one, right? The priest, maybe, right? But even then, the priest had to offer a sacrifice for himself. The priest died. The priest was temporary. He didn't live forever. The priest had his own problems. That there was no one really to guarantee man's part of the deal. And so they fail continually under that. Jesus is one who guarantees man's part. He's the surety of this new covenant, this new testament. And so we've got a new one and a better one. And this new covenant depends on what Jesus has done, not on what man does and the Old Testament priests do. You know, in verse 23, and they truly were many priests, because they were not suffered to continue by reason of death. That's kind of obvious. We talked about that they kept dying, so there kept being a priest after a priest after a priest after a priest. There was a lot of them. In verse 24, but this man, because he continueth ever, hath an unchangeable priesthood, that the priesthood under the law of Moses constantly changed because men were dying. But this man, now that he is a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, he's got a perpetual priesthood. And there's not going to be another. There's not going to be another that supersedes him. There's not going to be another change in the priesthood. This is the only priesthood that matters now, the only priesthood that's needed. And he's got a permanent priesthood. Jesus' priesthood is eternal. Jesus' priesthood will not pass away. Jesus' priesthood is non-transferable. Okay? We don't need to worry about a bad priest replacing him. There's not going to be any replacement. You know, in the Old Testament, it could have been good or bad depending upon the man, right? And you can read about some bad priests. But Jesus' priesthood will never stop. His position and as a priest never needs to be filled by another. And so what this does mean, what this doesn't mean, though, is that Jesus is in heaven operating and functioning as a priest for us. Okay, I need to point that out for you. Most people think that, okay, because Jesus is a priest, he must mean he works and operates according to the priests like the Old Testament and the law did. So he's up in heaven, you know, waving things and cutting bread and drinking stuff and taking baths and offering sacrifices, right? And so, again, you got to ask, and that's why I pointed out, if you look at the picture of here's what a priest is according to the law versus what's the priest according to Melchizedek, who knows? Maybe he, you know, rode horses and had a cowboy hat. Who knows? The point is that Jesus is not being a priest according to the Old Testament law, and that's not necessarily what he's doing up there right now. But regardless, he's got a perpetual priesthood, a perpetual priesthood. And verse 25, wherefore, because of that, and because of the context, because he's superior, because he's better, because he's got a priesthood that never dies, he is able also to save them to the uttermost that come unto God by him. Okay, it's telling him right now, he's able to save them who come to God. So it tells you, he's telling them, here's how you get saved. Here's how you get saved. You want to escape this constant system of failure and weakness and unprofitability? You need to come to God, but by who? By Him. If you come to God by Him, He's going to be able to save you. He's going to be able to deliver you from that constant awareness of sin, awareness of guilt, the burden of that system, the uselessness of the cleansing inside, the life that could not breathe. He's able to deliver you from all of that. He's able to save you and rescue you from all of that. It's in Him. But you need to come to God, not by just any priest and not by the sacrifices, but by Him. That's how He's a better hope. That's how He's a better hope. You need to come to God by Him. And it's telling these individuals, that he's able to save from the uttermost. He's able to save to the uttermost. It doesn't just say from the uttermost, right? And that Jesus is able to bring man to the presence of God. Not just that Jesus can save from all. That's almost obvious in the sense that he's able to rescue and save you from everything, but where to? That's of much greater importance, that not just that I got out of the pit, but where did I go? Into God's own presence, to the uttermost, that he's able to bring man to the presence of God in a real and permanent way. The unchanging nature of Jesus' priesthood means that the salvation he gives is also unchanging. It's permanent. It's secure. And then seeing, in the rest of verse 25, seeing he ever liveth to make intercession for them. And so what that means is Jesus is always up in heaven just praying for people and just praying. That's how I used to read it. That in Jesus makes intercession. My mind instantly thinks it must be words. It must be him praying. It must be Jesus praying on my behalf. Well, there's a variety of things that are wrong with that. The first one is that my assumption of the word intercession, that intercession doesn't necessarily mean words at all. It just means to intervene on someone's behalf. So sometimes when it comes up in the scripture, the way that we intervene on the behalf of others is through praying for them, right? There could be other ways we intervene. There could be other ways that we intervene for individuals. So I had a faulty assumption and a bias regarding this whole verse of what Jesus was doing because of one word, and it tainted. So now that that was, okay, resolved, okay, let's just assume it's not him praying, but it's still him intervening. Well, in what way is he intervening? I mean, in one sense, though, I mean, Jesus praying for him. I'm not going to say that Jesus doesn't pray for people. Do you understand? I'm just going to tell you, I don't think that's what this verse is talking about. Now, Jesus praying for me gives me strength, right? Or at least me thinking about Jesus praying for me would give me strength. That a knowledge of Jesus praying for me kind of helps me keep going, right? It kind of gives me motivation. But I don't, like I said, specifically in the context, this isn't talking about prayer. This isn't talking about Jesus praying. It's talking about him functioning as a high priest. And specifically, it says that seeing he ever liveth to make intercession for them. For them. In the context, who's them? Those who need to be saved. Those who need to be saved. Yes, Hebrews. Okay? Hebrews in the context. But them is seeing those who come to God by him who need to be saved. So it's unbelievers. Unbelievers. Okay? So at the very least, Jesus is praying for unbelievers and not me. So that's another reason why I couldn't be. And the other one is that maybe it's just him intervening. Well, in what way does he intervene as a priest, as a high priest? Well, sacrifice. That's the whole, what this whole context is coming up. Some people say, well, a high priest would intervene on the behalf of the rest of the group so that their prayers could be heard. And they talk about blood being poured out upon the mercy seat to show that this sacrifice was covering man's. It goes on and on. It's slightly confusing because there's nothing in here to indicate any of that. And so they're trying to squeeze it. The whole point of this verse is showing that Jesus intervenes as a high priest on what way? That he's able to provide the sacrifice that's necessary for man to be able to have access to God, to be saved. And in that way, he's living to intervene on their behalf. That doesn't mean that he's up there praying, or it doesn't mean that he's up there showing his dead body to God to say, hey, here's that sacrifice. It just means that work has been done, and he'll intervene whenever they turn to God. And that intercession is one of the ways in which he lives. He's alive. He is living. And in doing so, he is able to show that sacrifice that's necessary for those to come and be saved. And so it's not this Jesus praying for people. That's not even in the context. It's specifically for those who need to be saved, and specifically it's not just Jesus pleading the merits of his death to make sure God's convinced that these people can get saved. I think it's what the high priest did. One of the functions of the high priest was to offer sacrifice, which he did, and now he lives. He ever lives. So it's readily available for those to take it. And the chapter goes on, and we're almost done. In verse 26, For such a high priest became us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and made higher than the heavens. You know, each of these statements is worthy of attention. But again, he's trying to prove to the individuals he's writing to that this man is superior in his quality, in his character, in his makeup. And you can look at each one of these in detail, and it's worth your study to some degree to see, okay, this high priest, Jesus, oh, he's harmless. He's suitable for us because he's holy. He's without blame. He doesn't have guile. He's got no deception. He's innocent. He's got no malice to him. He's separate from sinners in the sense that he doesn't share in their sin, or he's separate from sinners and that he's exalted to heaven, made higher than the heavens. But Jesus is far superior. Jesus is far superior. And verse 27, who needeth not daily as those high priests to offer up sacrifice, first for his own sins and then for the people's. For this he did once when he offered up himself. He didn't need to offer up a sacrifice like the priests in the Old Testament did, because he didn't need to cover for anything. He was holy. He didn't have malice. He didn't need to clean himself. He was already clean. He was the only individual like that. And so this individual was greater than the priest because in the Old Testament, because they had to do that. They had to first provide a sacrifice for themselves. But this man, this priest, he was able to offer up a sacrifice once when he offered up himself. And this is the allusion, or not the allusion, this is the introduction, you know. In order for him to be an individual who is able to offer up a legitimate sacrifice to God, he needed to be a legitimate priest. He needed to be a legitimate high priest to be able to offer up the one sacrifice that mattered on that one day. And, you know, this is what it's talking about specifically, that those high priests would offer up one sacrifice, and that would be for the sins of everyone. That would be able to cover the whole year. The Day of Atonement you can read about in the Old Testament. But there were two things necessary in a sacrifice. That there was the priest and there was the sacrifice. And the writer has just proved, okay, he is a better priest according to the order of Melchizedek. And proved it from the scriptures, proved it from Levi was in the loins of Abraham. Abraham tithed to him. He blessed Abraham. He preceded him. He superseded him. He is so much better. Jesus is so much better. He alone is the only high priest that was able to bring perfection. He is the only high priest and man who's able to finally bring access to man. Jesus Christ didn't need to offer up regular sacrifices once and for all. And then verse 28, for the law maketh men high priests which have an infirmity. But the word of the oath, which was since the law, maketh the Son who is consecrated forever. Remember that oath, with respect to the quote that comes up in Psalm 110, was 500 or so years after the law. And it was another confirmation that God was working all along to supersede the system you've been so exposed to. And with that priesthood is going to come a new covenant. And with that priesthood also means that there's a better sacrifice. There's a better sacrifice. And that's what the rest of chapter 8 and following is going to get into, is regarding how that better sacrifice accomplished something on your behalf. But look at verse 1 of chapter 8. It says, now, of the things which we have spoken, this is the sum. We have such a high priest who is set on the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heavens. And so, you know, it's that he's the man. We've just looked at all these cases and the superiority of Jesus' high priest after the order of Melchizedek. There was no need for a rigorous examination of genealogy. Jesus' priesthood did not depend on his ancestry. Jesus had an eternal priesthood. Jesus lives forever. He's never going to die. The priest received tithes from the people. Melchizedek was a priest and a king who received tithes from Abraham, the father of the patriarchs. This priesthood was promised. It wasn't by commandment. That God appointed an oath that the Levitical priests were fallible and sinful men, but Jesus was holy and undefiled. The Levitical priests were only by their office, you know, distinguished a little bit better because of their office. This man was higher than the heavens. Jesus is sinless and doesn't need to offer a sacrifice for his own sin. Jesus offered a perfect and adequate sacrifice. Why would anyone want to go back? Why would you want to stop there? Why would you want to stop in the old system? There's a brand new and better one that's come. And so the writer to the Hebrews is merciful but urgent. And, you know, he makes this great claim that Jesus is the man. Jesus is the one who has fulfilled this. And this is the one you need to believe in. And so, you know, like I mentioned, this has been a weekend that has been and relatively simple in the sense like it's not necessarily, we're not Jews and not directed to us, but I trust that and on the behalf of that you've learned quite a bit about Jesus and his superiority that will help you and affect the rest of your life in all areas, not just an understanding of how to deal with Jews in the future, but seeing Jesus in his fullness and appreciating him. And, you know, I'd like to thank you on the behalf of the teachers and myself for letting us teach this subject. It's been rewarding for us, I can say, and mention, and hope that this has been a blessing to you. So thanks for coming, and if we got anything else, then we'll see you back in Columbus. God bless.